The Clare Byrne Show on News Talk
with Aviva Insurance.
I have not one but two authors with me now in the studio. The two authors of the hugely successful Aisling series of books have a brand new book out. It's not about Aisling though this time. It's called Our Deadly Summer. I have it here in my hand and I'm delighted to be joined in the studio by Eimear MacLysett and Sarah Breen. You're both welcome.
Good morning. Hello,
how are you? Thank you.
I'm great. Do you like this bit of the book experience?
I have to say it would be probably my least favourite part.
You see, I knew that about you. I read it. And radio interviews in particular are not your thing, Sarah.
I get very stressed. I took half a Valium last night, I will admit.
You did not.
I did. I always feel like when I'm on the radio, I'm interrupting someone's day, that they're going about their business. And then here I am talking about my book. And like compared to the actual writing of the book, which is very solitary and you're just by yourself writing your little sentences, I find, yeah, this part much more difficult. But we're very lucky to be here as well.
But you are an author of acclaim at this stage. Do you know what I mean? You've done this a number of times.
I know, it's been like almost 10 years of radio interviews, so why do I get so nervous?
And she's well able to talk.
You're well able to talk.
Thank you.
And the books have been really successful, you know, so you've earned your place, but you're not feeling it yet, I can see.
I never will, I'd say.
Eimear, what about you?
I used to work in radio, so
you're
less.
Okay with it.
I actually used to read the news on News Talk years and years
Did
ago.
You?
Yeah. So if anyone, you know, if anyone's sick today, I can pop in.
You're very comfortable.
Yeah, I don't get as nervous. I hate doing TV stuff. That's kind of where that's the kind of line for me. I'm like, I really wish we didn't have to do that. Now, thank God there isn't as much of that. And again, we're very lucky to be able to do it and stuff. But yeah, I'm less nervous. But sometimes you do kind of realise, God, how many people are listening?
Oh, don't, Eimear,
please. What if I say
I can't
something?
Think about that.
Yeah.
Don't think about that.
No.
I have a little thing that I have. Someone said to me once, you're talking to multiples of the people who sit in Croke Park when you're in the studio.
None of this is helping.
That's horrifying.
Do you know what I do, Sarah? I never think of that.
No.
Okay, good.
No,
picture
I would never think
that
of that.
Get that out of your head. Do you miss Aisling when you're talking about this book at all?
We do, but we actually have been continuing to write about Aisling on Substack, which is like an online platform.
So she's there.
So she's there. She's always with us and she's been with us for, God, how long now? 20,
it is.
20 years more?
Yeah, we've been talking about it. We talked about Aisling for a long time before we wrote about her in the novels.
So this is, it's probably then a relief to have a new departure, is it? A new character?
When we sat down to write this book, we were like, it's very difficult not to just write Aisling. So there's two main characters in the book, Laura and Dee. And I was like, are we just writing Aisling and her best friend Magella? That was a concern. So we were really focusing on not writing Aisling and Magella. But we still wanted them to be, like, they're the type of characters we write.
Mm-hmm.
So they're...
Yeah, I see exactly what you mean. You don't want to fall back into the...
No, so they're characters that we think are in the Aisling universe. Like, they could easily be in an Aisling book, but they're not Aisling, they're not Magella, they're very different. But Aisling, people always said about Aisling, like, she's kind of an Irish everywoman. So there's a bit of Aisling in Laura and Dee, definitely. Like, there's Aisling-tastic stuff that happens to them.
Aisling in everybody.
Oh, obviously, you know?
Yeah. Aisling, yeah.
I was looking at who else does collabs, and I was looking at James Patterson. I was thinking, okay, it's okay for him, because he'll do a collab and then he'll move on with that. And
Didn't he do Bill Clinton? Was that his collab?
Yeah, he does, but he does loads.
I love that you're calling it a collab. Like, it's on Instagram. Hashtag collab.
But you wonder how much Bill Clinton is feeding into the manuscript.
Well,
you
look,
know?
This is it, right? But for you two, you're sort of living in each other's lives as friends and as authors. Is it? It's really unusual, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we're very lucky. I remember years ago at an event that we did, Deirdre O'Kane was in the audience and she asked a question at the end. And of course, we were quite starstruck that she was even there. And she asked, like, do you realise how lucky you are to have a friendship and you can collaborate together? And at the time, we didn't, because everything was happening so fast and we hadn't really thought about it. But now I think we realise, you know, we are very lucky and we have really preserved our friendship, because I think the misconception is that we get together and we talk about work all the time and we're brainstorming books ideas. But that is not the case. Like, we will go away on holidays for 2 weeks and never mention books once. Like, we holiday with a larger group and, you know, maybe once in the holiday, Eimear will swim up to me in the pool and go, wouldn't this be a good idea for a book? And just say a phrase and then I'll say, okay. And then we'll never talk about work.
Yeah, we kind of pepper work stuff in, but it's never taking over. And even if we're on holidays or we're with our friends and they're like, how's work going, it's like, please
don't talk.
I'm not asking you about
don't
work
talk
let's
about
not
work.
Talk about it. No, but like we don't sit around and talk about it. It kind of interrupts our friend time.
We used to do this thing in school where someone would write a paragraph of a story and then you'd pass it around the class.
Yes.
Is that how it works?
Like, kind pretty of. Much.
Yeah. Yeah, kind of. We
is
are,
it chapter by chapter? Or
it usually starts out like that. So when we wrote the very first Aisling book, we had to come up with a system. We had never written a book before. We didn't know how one person writes a book, let alone two. So we did split up the first few chapters and said, right, you write that one and I'll write that one. And then we'll come back together and decide what happens in the next few. And we've kind of stuck with that system. Yeah. And we stuck with it for this book. But this book is different in that it has two different time periods. It moves back and forth between the two.
Yeah.
And it's a very different structure to an Aisling book. So that was challenging. And I think that's more challenging with two people because always continuity is an issue when writing books at all. So with two people and then with two different timelines. So we worked hard to make sure that worked out.
Are you okay with having the conversation, you know, oh, he wouldn't do that or she wouldn't say that?
Yeah, like when you do a first draft, you're really just getting the idea down on paper and it they call it the vomit draft. So it's like, it can be nonsense. And then it's really in your second draft that you go back and analyse, okay, you track people's moods, you know, depending on what's happening. And like, we will have conversations about like, oh, is this a bit of an overreaction to this and does this need to be toned down? But we're always very much on the same page in that we want the manuscript to be as good as it can possibly be. And I know some people are very precious about their writing and they don't take criticism well, but
I'm like, bring all the criticism because we need to make this better.
And you're never saying, oh, she did nothing last week and we're up against it with the deadline or vice versa? No,
like we've come up against elements of that. So I'm I call it clinical procrastination. It actually is confirmed now because have ADHD, but I'm a massive procrastinator and Sarah is more of a front loading the work. And so there have been lots of times where I'm like very much last minute and she's probably going, oh God, I wish she'd do this work. But it always gets done. And Sarah knows that it's going to get done. It just might be very, very last minute.
Do you like deadlines then? And when the deadline is approaching, does it motivate you to
work? Like deadlines? No, but that's the only thing that will get me to do something.
I kind of like a deadline. I like it to put me under pressure.
And I will push it to the limit.
Whereas you're prepping for ages in advance of the deadline.
Well, not really in advance. Like, I'm a regular amount of procrastinator, but I have three school-age children and we've been doing this for long enough in that I know that somebody will get chicken pox or something will happen. And I also know that the way Emer works, she tends to leave things the last minute. So between the two of us, we are kind of working consistently.
We set our schedule around those things, around Sarah's schedule at home and the children and her work and then my procrastination and the work. So we've made it work. Like we set our time according to those things.
And I don't think it would work if we weren't friends. Like, we make allowances for each other and we're very like gentle with each other.
Yeah.
Like, sometimes people have bad weeks and you mentioned there, like, are there times where nobody gets the work done? And there are definitely weeks like that. Like, we're self-employed, so we are each other's bosses.
Yeah.
We are very good bosses to each other.
Oh, very good.
Like, take a day off. Sometimes Emer will observe the school holidays because I observe the school holidays.
I love observing a school holiday.
The midterm break, she's not working.
I love observing. I'm like the meddling aunt in Sarah and her husband Owen's relationship. I'm just like, here I am too.
My kids are about to be off school tomorrow. Take the day off.
Yeah.
Well, everyone's taking the day off
Taking the day off. Might do a bit of co-parenting.
Why not?
So tell me about this book now, because I know the J1 features heavily. You two met in college, right?
Mm-hmm. We met in college.
Didn't go together on the J1.
No, I did a J1 in the early 2000s. I went to Long Island, which is where this book is set. I don't think you can write about a place that isn't Ireland, really, if you don't have a good experience of being there. So we that's why we kind of decided to set it there. I went early 2000. Sarah didn't do an official J1, but she kind of did.
I went and met my friend who was on a J1 in Montauk, which is also in Long Island. This is before Emer and I knew each other. So he was working on a fishing boat called the Flying Cloud. And I went, me and my friend went and stayed with him. And I want to say 15 or 18 other Irish students in this house. And like, he had us working on the boat. We were taking turns sleeping on the couch. So I think I got a good sense of the J1 experience, except I didn't get paid.
Yeah, I was in a house with eight other girls, seven Irish girls and one Russian girl. And we worked in a country club. We were waitresses. And that's what Laura and Dee do in the book.
I love that. I'd say that was an experience in itself, wasn't it?
It was an experience. Yeah, it was just like the attitude that some of the members of the country club had towards us. It was very much like, these poor, destitute Irish girls have come from potato land to send money home to Like there was a bit of like, oh, they have to send money home to their, you know, starving relatives.
And it
was
you like, never told them you were there for the crack.
Oh no, they would be like, do you have 10 pound bowling? And we'd be like, no, what's that?
But it was very fancy. Like before we ever started writing this book, you used to talk about the J1 experience that you had. And you had to carry like a silver tray on your shoulder. You couldn't put a tray down in front of the guests.
Yeah, there,
like,
it was kind of silver service training. So you had to, there were all these rules. And like, it was a great summer, but we worked so hard. We came home with money. Most people don't come home from their J1s with money, but because we worked 6 days a week, it was
no time to spend it.
No time to spend it. And we were under 21. So the roots of spending
fun. No fun at
we had
all.
One bar where we had quite a lot of fun where they turned a blind eye. But in the book, Laura and Dee do work in a country club in Long Island, which is kind of loosely based on the place I worked. And the book opens with them standing over a dead body. And then we're kind of working backwards to see, it's not really who done it. It's who is the dead body. And it's not really, I don't really see it like a crime or murder mystery. It's more about the friendship between Laura and Dee and how it endures through the summer and through this horrific incident.
And there's a lot in there about how men treat women, particularly at that age as well. You go on your J1 and it's the first real taste of adult mm-hmm. freedom that you have and everything that comes with that, how you're learning about the world and interactions and relationships in that time when you're free.
Yeah, and like our girls have moved from, our girls were going to college in Dublin, so they were like a little bit freer. But then when you move across the Atlantic, it kind of changes everything. They're wearing things that they wouldn't have worn at home. They're making decisions that they wouldn't have made at home, and they're getting themselves into situations that maybe, you know, they might regret afterwards. And because it's set between back then and the present day, it's interesting to see Laura and Dee looking back and thinking, you know, oh, would I have done things differently? Like I didn't have agency in certain interactions I had with men. And, you know, I look back sometimes and think about interactions I've had and it's uncomfortable to think, you know,
yeah,
that, you know, people weren't talking about consent as much as they're talking about it now, for example.
Yeah, it's very much pre-Me Too and pre-mobile phones everywhere and people tracking each other's movements. So,
although Kate Blanchett said at the weekend, Me Too died a very quick death.
Yeah.
No, I wonder, have things changed since that time? Since you guys were on your J1s.
I would hope that attitudes, even young women and young people themselves, I would hope that even their own attitudes to how they're treated and how they want to enjoy their lives and how they want to enjoy being in relationships. Because definitely when I was younger, it was like, okay, this is what I'm expected to do. And I'm sure there is still elements of that, but it was just never talked about. And it was, you know, I think Sarah and I often joke, but it's not really a joke. It's like, how did one of us not end up in like a really, really dangerous situation. Yeah. Well, and it's just by luck.
Well, you'd
I think.
Hope as well that maybe the attitudes of men to women as well changed.
Yeah.
I don't know. These are big and difficult questions to answer.
Yeah, we're hoping. Like I
remember being like going out and like, hopefully this doesn't happen anymore because, you know, girls are more on it and, you know, they're able to stick up for themselves. But like being groped in nightclubs and like getting your bum pinched and like just men.
I remember being thrown out of a Dublin nightclub for slapping somebody who had sexually assaulted me, and I was thrown out because I hit him. Yeah,
because you made a fuss.
Yeah, it was like she's causing. I don't even think I'd had a drink. It was like.
And did you try to object and protest your innocence and your right to do what you?
Yeah,
you did?
I remember it was on the stairs in a Dublin nightclub that I don't think exists anymore. But I think I was like, but he touched me, and it was like, get out, don't care.
End of story.
You're causing trouble.
The other big theme of the book then is friendship as well. And, and clearly, because what we have going on here, that is a big storyline in your own lives. And you mentioned that you go on holidays with a big group of people. Mm-hmm. You sound as though you're all really, really tight, like a family.
Yeah, it's kind of our found family. Mm. When me and Emma became friends, I became friends with girls that she went to school with. And one of those guys, he went to school with the man who went on to become my husband. So it's all very connected.
It's a very intermingled group now. I've kind of lost track of where...
Who knows who from...
They start and, you know, we're just all really... So we have a really close group of 11, which is adults and children, that we go on a lot of holidays together. And then we've loads of other friends, like Sarah's friends that she's been friends with since she was 5. Are now really close. Like I would text them, or, you know, I'd see them not that often. Sarah's like, what do you mean you see them without me? But like they're good friends of mine.
Such a life bonus though to have that.
That's
fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, it's such a, and when you hear, and we cover it on the programme, what are the best strategies to keep yourself young and healthy as you age? Friendships.
Oh, absolutely.
Social connections, yeah. all of those things that make you feel well.
Yeah, keeping those channels open that, you know, I think when some people get into relationships or maybe have to move somewhere for family reasons, their circle might close over a bit. And what Sarah has definitely done, and she said she has three children and a husband and lots of her friends do, is keep it open and make sure you still have a good time. And don't, like, going on holidays together is, and we do it on the, like, we don't have a lot of money to spend when we're going on these holidays, and we've become experts at finding houses that will fit 11 people on a budget.
Now you see, you've dispersed the old trope that if you have anything in print at all, you're absolutely loaded, coming down with cash. They're coming up to your house with trailer full, loads of it. That's not the case in publishing. But if you get the telly deal off the back of it, that changes. Isn't that the case?
Well, I think if it gets made.
If it gets made.
So there's a lot of things that happen behind the scenes and things that don't come to fruition. For example, our first book was optioned shortly after it came out, which is 9 years ago, and we developed that for the screen for years and years and years. It was a film first and then it was a TV show, and you make small amounts of money as you're doing it, but it never actually came to fruition. But when you see something on screen, that's when the payday happens.
But that might happen yet for Aisling, surely.
Oh yeah, I mean, she's always going to be there.
I'm
always thinking about different ways we could, like, move her onto the screen. And what the thing with Aisling is, that's all written in the first person, and that's really hard to translate onto a screen because it suddenly becomes this multi-person, multi-dimensional thing. It's not just inside her head. Mm-hmm. So
I wonder, is it my lack of imagination, but I see Aisling B as being Aisling?
Yeah,
She'd be a great Aisling.
She would be a great Aisling, wouldn't she?
Yeah, she's very funny.
It's so funny. When we started working on the Aisling script, there were actors that were too young to play Aisling. And by the time we finished, there were actors who had been nominated for Oscars. They were too old to play Aisling. Yeah, they had aged out. So, yeah, God, the future Aisling could be, she could be five.
She might not be born yet.
Yeah.
Listen, thank you so much for coming in, and good luck with the rest of the promotion for the book. It's been so lovely to have you here. It's called Our Deadly Summer. It's available now, or is it out in 2 days?
It's officially out.
On the 21st, isn't it?
On the 21st, but it's available in a good few bookshops.
Okay. I've seen it in the window of Debray.
Yeah, and it's bright green, so you can't miss
it. It's bright green, as are your nails, Emer, to match. It's called again, Our Deadly Summer, by Emer MacLysett and Sarah Breen. Lovely to have you here, and continued success to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
The Claire Byrne Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekday mornings at 9 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.